practice Krishna consciousness. We call that blupt. So, in the early days of the movement, Prabhupada would talk about how the living entity falls into the material ocean, like a rock falls into a lake. Boop, bloop, 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 bloop. So Prabhupada would speak like that. A rock, living entity falls like in a lake. Boop. I don't know exactly what Prabhupada said, if he said it makes a sound like bloop, or they just thought a rock sounds like bloop when it falls down. So, somehow or other, that got in some devotee's mind that bloop was actually a word, but it's not a word in the English language. So some devotee left Krishna consciousness, and since Prabhupada hadn't seen that devotee for a while, Prabhupada asked, where is so-and-so? And one devotee said, oh, Prabhupada, he blooped. You know, because that's the sound. And Prabhupada didn't know what the word know, never heard the word bloop, because it's not an English word. It's a made-up word. So Prabhupada said, what is this bloop? Then the devotee went on to explain, well, he left Krishna consciousness. And Prabhupada said, then if he blooped, what can be done? So then Prabhupada adopted the word. So that's the origin of the word bloop. So this article we're going to read from now, which defines the need that we have to deal with guilt, and it also defines why, answers the question why guilt exists, especially in spiritual life. This article was titled Fall Down in Krishna Consciousness, and it was actually a discussion. It was a transcription of a group discussion. There were 5-6 devotees discussing. It was in a BTG maybe 20 years ago. It's very interesting. So Rabindra Sarup says as follows, and I will explain it after we read it. If I'm fallen, that means fallen meaning if I don't follow perfectly, they're talking here about fallen. It means you might follow a little bit, but you don't follow perfectly. If I'm fallen, then I'm a divided person. I've got an internalized set of ideals. In other words, I know what I should do. It's within me. I know what's right. Why do I know what's right? Where do the ideals come from? The spiritual master, the community, what's right, what's wrong, according to what we establish in this community. Krishna, what Krishna has told you is right and wrong. This is the way you ought to be. So these internalized set of ideals means everything you hear about what is right and what is wrong, what is proper action, what is improper action. Everything you get socially from the community, oh, don't eat with your left hand, or you know, little thing, don't eat with your left, don't touch that, to a bigger thing. And then you have Krishna's instructions. And so internalized means you understand this is how I should be. This is what is right. This is what is wrong. And you internalize that. It becomes clear to you. Right? Does that make sense? This is how I should be. This is how a devotee thinks. This is how a devotee behaves. And so the question is, he's saying, but if I don't follow that, I become divided. What does he mean by divided? He explains here. And my own perception is, I'm not that way. In other words, this is the way I'm supposed to be, and this is the way I am. So I become divided means I'm not whole, I'm not congruent, I'm not aligned, I'm not one with what I believe I should be. So he goes on to say, so one develops an acute sense of being ill at ease, and there are a few really unhealthy reactions. In other words, I should be like this, but I'm like this, so I don't. I feel uncomfortable with myself because I'm not doing what I know I should do. Is that clear? And this also explains, although he's not saying this, it explains why one might feel guilty. Where does guilt come from? When you know you should do something and you don't do it, you'll feel guilty. You don't feel guilty doing what you know you should do, do you? You only feel guilty when you don't do it. I know I should have done that, but I didn't. I shouldn't have said that, but I did. I shouldn't have acted that way, but I did. Because you know it's the wrong way. If it's not the wrong way, and you acted that way, you won't feel guilty. Right? You only feel guilty when it's the wrong way. When you know it's not the right way. So then he's saying, he's making an interesting point here, because there's two ways you deal with guilt. One way is you honestly acknowledge this is wrong what I'm doing, and then you try to rectify it. He's explaining another way that you can deal with it, which is not healthy. And he, therefore he says, you know, because it's like you're not feeling comfortable with yourself because you did something wrong, and so the right way to do that is to recognize I did something wrong and rectify it. But he's saying the unhealthy way to deal with it would be this way. So he says there's a few unhealthy reactions. One is to indulge in bluffing, hypocrisy, kind of pretending you didn't do the wrong thing, or you do the wrong thing but you don't let anybody know and you pretend that everything is fine. That's one way to deal with it. Rather than say, I did the wrong thing, I should rectify, I should correct myself. One way is just you don't want anybody to know, or you pretend to yourself that it wasn't the wrong thing. You kind of rationalize it. Well, this is why I did it, it's not that bad. It's, you know, like that. That's bluffing. Another is simply to propagate a different standard. In other words, you change the philosophy. Well, this is artificial. I know nobody's doing this. So, let's change the philosophy. It's the wrong, trying to get everybody to be so strict. Nobody can be strict. Prabhupada, if he was still here, he would have changed the standard, seeing that so many people can't follow it. Things like that. So everyone's bluffing. Everyone's pretending. We can't be expected to follow these things. It's artificial. Everyone who's following is just artificially repressing. Things like that. You have a new philosophy. And so if you change the philosophy, then what you did is not bad. And then if you change the philosophy, then it's okay to be fallen and you won't feel guilty. Which is kind of an interesting concept, because we want to look at the question, is it all right to feel guilty or is it wrong to feel guilty? And so, if you look at it this way, someone might say, you shouldn't feel guilty, it's wrong. So how do you deal with it? You just change the philosophy. Actually, what I did wasn't bad. People say it's bad, but actually not bad. You come up with a new idea. This actually happened in our movement. I don't know if you're aware of this, but one of the biggest leaders in our movement, a couple of them actually, were not able to follow one of the regulative principles and they left. And they began changing the philosophy, saying Prabhupada made a mistake in enforcing no illicit sex. It's not healthy, people can't do it. One even went on to say it's actually spiritual. Breaking that principle is actually spiritual. And we don't understand it. So a new philosophy, if not following the no illicit sex principle, if you change it around, you say, no, it's actually spiritual, you just don't understand it. Or if you say, it's an artificial repression that nobody can do, which causes psychological problems. So you're going to make all these people crazy because they're trying to control themselves and they can't. This is what they came up with. So by coming up with a new philosophy, then what they're doing is actually better than the people who are controlling themselves. Because the people who are controlling themselves are either going to go crazy because it's so hard to control, or they're not taking advantage or not understanding that sex is actually spiritual. So they're actually better. That's what it came out to be. This is true, real life, true ISKCON history. And the two people that came up with this philosophy were probably amongst the five most powerful and successful sannyasis in the movement before they left. It's amazing. Huh? So that's something to just understand and be careful that that tendency can be there. If you then he says, here's another way people deal with it, which is similar. They join another group in which that behavior, which is not acceptable in Vaishnavism, is acceptable in that group. Then you won't feel guilty. So he said, well, some devotees, not a lot, but some devotees have become Christians. Because in Christianity, a lot of the things which we say are bad are not. Or even if they're bad, you can go to church and be forgiven. So even if you commit that sin, often you can be forgiven. So then, there's someone that once said, better to be a good Christian than a bad Hare Krishna. So I'm doing exactly the same thing. My activities are the same, but as a devotee, it'll be considered these are not proper, but as a Christian, it is considered proper. So now, you feel good. At least I'm a good Christian. I don't feel guilty anymore. So the point here is that this is not a healthy way to deal with guilt, because it's an avoidance of the problem, and it's a rationalization to make yourself feel good. So there are healthier ways to deal with guilt, and we're going to discuss that. So then, Ravinda Sarup says, these are unhealthy reactions. Better to be, and then Jai Dwaita Swami interrupts and says, honest. And Ravinda Sarup says, better to be honestly fallen. That's great progress. In other words, it's better to acknowledge I made a mistake and I'm fallen than to pretend I didn't, or to bluff, or to be a hypocrite, or to come up with a new philosophy to rationalize. Prabhupada, why did you do that? Everybody does it. Is that a good reason to do it? Everyone in America has abortion. Why don't you all have abortion? But sometimes we do that. Well, why did you do that? Because everybody does it. I know all the devotees are doing it. How do you know? I just know. I can tell. It doesn't solve the problem for you. So he's saying, better to be honestly fallen. Just admit, why did you do it? Because I'm fallen. That's, he said. And so then Rabindra Swarup says, that's great progress. If you just admit I'm fallen, that's progress. Because that's humility. But the other thing is not humility, it's pride. Right? So to admit I made a mistake, that's good. We should do that. Alright, it's bad that we make mistakes, but it's good that we admit we make mistakes. Right? So we don't try to hide the fact. And so he says that's great progress. Why is that great progress? Because that's the point from where you advance. Because if you just rationalize it, you can't solve the problem. But here you recognize it's a problem and you're ready to deal with it. Then he goes on to explain. He said, what bluffing and hypocrisy do is make one a fault finder. Like we're saying. You're fallen, but to rationalize it, you point your finger at other people. Well, they're doing that also. This one is worse than I am. That doesn't help you solve your problem. Then he says another interesting thing happens. Sometimes, and I'll give you a story to go with this. Sometimes we're not following correctly, and we should be honest enough to deal with it, admit it, and rectify it. He said, but what devotees sometimes do is they don't want to acknowledge that. And what they'll do is they'll be successful in their service. And by being successful in their service, they'll equate that with being advanced in Krishna consciousness. And so they kind of get rid of the guilt by, well, I collect a lot of money, or I build a lot of temples, or I distribute a lot of books. That's wonderful. But on the other side, there may be a problem that you need to rectify, but you don't acknowledge the problem by doing something successful, and you feel good, I'm a successful devotee. So you don't confront the guilt, you avoid it, and do something to make yourself feel good, and prove to yourself that actually I'm a good devotee. I'm not at fault, I haven't made a mistake. Because look at what I did, I built this temple. You want to hear a story about this? There was one, I mean, I hate to tell you all these things because some of you don't even know. It's kind of depressing, but I think it's important that we understand the past history, where mistakes were made. There was one guru, GBC Sannyasi, who later left ISKCON, but some of the God brothers were concerned that he wasn't chanting 16 rounds because we never saw him chant his rounds. He never chanted with the devotees. And we knew often in the morning he would do other things. So, and we kind of calculated, you know, because what he was doing in the morning and what he did all day, and we couldn't figure out when is he chanting his rounds. And enough people recognized that he probably wasn't, that they were willing to confront him. And in those days, you had to be very careful if you confronted a guru, because the concept of guru right after Prabhupada left was it would almost be like going to Prabhupada and say, Prabhupada, I don't see you chanting 16 rounds. Are you chanting? Which, of course, nobody would do that unless they were crazy. So it was a little bit like that. You were treading on thin ice, you could get a severe reaction. Disciples might really become upset with you. Some God brothers may be upset with you who were very close to the guru. How dare you question him like that? Nowadays we know better. If we see a problem, we'll go to that person and say, we don't see you chanting, can you chant with us? Are you chanting? Do you want to talk about it? And nowadays most people would, if they had a problem, would just admit it and talk about it. But he responded by saying, he was very successful. He said, he didn't say he was or he wasn't. He just said, you see how successful I am? he was extremely successful. She asked, could anybody be that successful if they weren't chanting? That was his answer. He didn't say yes, and he didn't say no. So that meant he was revealing his own psychology. That's how he dealt with the fact that he wasn't chanting his rounds. It didn't matter to him anymore because he was successful. So success becomes a standard which rectifies another problem. Doesn't matter if you're not chanting 16 rounds, just be the number one book distributor. And in your mind, you're okay. So you don't feel guilty. So these are unhealthy ways of dealing with guilt. And I'm going to explain another unhealthy way. And I'm going to tell you something that's going to spin your mind around completely. Very, very interesting. The problem in talking about this subject is Prabhupada only said one thing about guilt. There's not a lot. You can go to the folio, the word doesn't come up. It's not deeply ingrained within Vaishnavism. It's deeply ingrained in Christianity, but not in Vaishnavism. The word remorse is used a little more. Remorse means you feel bad and you correct yourself. So it's similar to guilt. You know, if you feel remorseful, you've done something wrong. Remorse means I'll never do that again. If you deeply feel it. So it's close to guilt, and that's more the word that's used. Bhaktivinoda Thakur uses it. Bhaktivinoda Thakur said you should actually feel remorseful for committing nama aparad. And said you can feel that remorse when you're chanting. Hare Krishna, oh Krishna, please forgive me for ever committing namaparad. It's nice, huh? Nice meditation. Any of you ever feel remorseful for not chanting well? If you don't, you should. It's good because it helps you chant. See, remorse is meant to correct. If you feel bad, some people say, I feel bad about something, but they don't do anything about it. They just feel bad about it. But remorse means you feel bad and you correct yourself. You feel so bad, you don't want to do it again. So if you feel very remorseful about chanting your rounds, and for so many years I didn't chant my rounds well, if you feel very remorseful, it can correct. You can correct yourself. It's a good way to correct yourself because you feel bad. You feel that I can't go on chanting, making aparad to Krishna's name. Anyway, here's the conversation where Prabhupada spoke about guilt. It's the only one that I found. So the devotee, I'll give you a little history, the devotee who is asking this question was trained as a priest or a theologian. That was his background. So he became a devotee, so he has this whole body of knowledge of Christianity. You know, not like a normal Christian, but this is what he studied for years. To be a priest. So he asked Prabhupada this question. Srila Prabhupada, the theologians call this contrition. They're talking about guilt. They call it contrition. It means an actual thinking about how sinful we are, meditating on our sinful conditions. So the Christians do this. It's a meditation. I'm so fallen, I'm so bad, I'm so low, I'm so sinful. So he's asking Prabhupada, is that good? Prabhupada said, yes. Simply meditating on sinful condition, that is also good. But what is the counteraction? That we must know. Just like one man is suffering from some disease, he knows that I have infected this disease. So simply thinking, I have been infected by this disease, that is not good. He must go to a physician to cure it. That is intelligence. You understand? He's asking if you're just meditating on how sinful you are and you keep committing the same sin, or you're just absorbed in the fact that you're sinful. That's part of it, but it's not all of it, because that doesn't get you out of the sin. Sunderlal, you want to translate for the, into Creole? Because that devotee wanted a Creole translation. And I was thinking they could, everyone could sit in the chairs back there and get a Creole translation. But I don't know, he just disappeared anyway. Maybe someone can find him. So one disciple says, yes, it's like a criminal. If he commits a crime, it's nice that he laments, but he can't just lament. He has to start working positively. Prabhupada, yes, he must go to the state and offer, please kill me. Then the state may consider, I have committed this murder, the law is I must give my life, so I'm prepared. Then immediately he will be excused. So we have two things here. One is acknowledgement, and one is now rectification. Now I'm going to read, tell you the thing that's going to spin your mind around. I did something dangerous. I did two things dangerous in ISKCON, and they were both very similar. I decided I wanted to create a workshop on vows because I thought we all take vows, so we should understand what it means to take a vow, and we should understand how to make our vows strong so that we can follow them our entire life. And then when I began thinking, I thought, you know, it's kind of unusual that ISKCON is 43 years old and there's no course on vows and everybody takes vows, and there's no support group once you take your vows if you're having trouble. You have emergency numbers here? Like if there's an emergency, you call the police? You have a number like that? What is it? 911? 999. So then I thought, in America, I don't know if you have here, they have actually a suicide hotline. If somebody's thinking committing suicide, you can call and talk to someone who will talk you out of it. So I thought, in ISKCON, you need a, I don't know what you'd call it, you call it a hotline here? Yeah, you need a four regs, you know, you call it a suicide hotline. You know, I'm about to break the principle, and you talk to somebody before you do it, you know. I'm about to walk into the, about to go to the liquor store and buy a bottle of vodka or whatever you sell here. And then you call 999, or you call 108, star 108, and then you get a devotee and he talks you out of it. Or you have a monthly meeting for the support group, the four regular principal support group. We meet every month just to instill our regular practices. So I thought, actually it's kind of funny that we don't have that, because we're asking people to do things that practically nobody in the material world can do. Right? No meat eating, no intoxication, no illicit sex, no gambling. Practically even the priest in the Catholic Church can't even do that. Right? And we're asking just common householders working a job gets initiated to do that. So I thought, this is really important. So I began developing the workshop, and then we ran into the dangerous situation. What was the danger? The danger is, let's say some devotee is having trouble following a regular principle. And you get very heavy and you say, Prabhupada said, and this is true, Prabhupada said this, if you promise to follow and you can't follow, you are an animal. Did you know Prabhupada said that? He said, because you're a human being, you make a promise, you should follow. He said, an animal can't make a promise. Can we turn this down? It keeps feeding back. Can you just turn it down? Then I'll put it closer. So now, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. Better, yeah. So now, that's good, yeah. Why is that dangerous? Because if somebody's having difficulty following, telling them they're an animal may not be the most encouraging thing to tell them, right? You may want to tell them, I understand, it's difficult, let's talk about it, what can we do, what steps can we take? So the danger was I was treading in some dangerous waters, how to present this. And if you present it too lightly, then people will take it lightly. So there was a devotee counselor in Alachua. And devotee counselor, one of the main things, there's basically two things that I'm aware of, there may be more, but the two main things I'm aware of that devotee counselors deal with are marriage problems and problems with devotees not keeping their vows, either chanting or the four regular principles. That's a very common thing that comes to the counselors. So I thought, well, I'll go to her because she's dealing with this. People are coming to her all the time saying, I haven't chanted my rounds in a year, I can't follow all the principles, I feel miserable, how do I deal with it? So I said, how do you deal with it? Because I wanted to deal with it in a way which wouldn't upset devotees, but I wanted to deal with it in a way that would help them. And I was reluctant to just say what Prabhupada said. If you don't follow, you're an animal. I mean, sometimes I say that, but some people, when they hear that, it helps them. Some people, when they hear that, they get discouraged. I'm just an animal. What's the use? So I said, what do you tell them? I said, if somebody comes to you, get ready to have your brain spin around. I think this spins everyone's brain around, but I think Mauritians, it'll spin your brain around even faster and more than devotees in other places. I said, what do you tell somebody when they come to you and they say, I'm not chanting my rounds? She says, I tell them, you don't have to chant your rounds. Is your brain spinning? You wanna know why she said that? Are you interested? Should I tell you why? It's very interesting psychology. She said, they're not chanting their rounds any. They're coming to me, they're not even chanting. So if I tell them you don't have to chant, it doesn't change anything. Externally, physically, because they're not chanting anyway. She said, what's happening is they're not chanting, and by not chanting, they're feeling guilty they're not chanting. And because they feel guilty, they don't chant. It's a cycle, right? You don't chant, therefore you feel guilty, and the guilt causes you not to chant. And that guilt is pressuring them down. It's the mode of ignorance. It's pushing them down. It's actually the reason they're not chanting, is they feel so guilty. She said, by telling them you don't have to chant, I remove that guilt. By making them realize you don't have to chant, but if you want to, if you really want to do it from your heart, then that's where it comes from. It's not because, and see, the other thing she told me, she said, these people would come to her and they would say, you know, when I was in the temple chanting 16 rounds, I was only doing it because I felt pressure. Not that everybody only chants because they feel pressure, but these people would often say, I just did it because I felt pressure from other people. I didn't even want to do it. I had to do it. I didn't want to. Or they had different reasons where they didn't want to chant, but they were doing it. So when they got out of the temple, they just stopped. So by this one thing telling them, you don't have to chant, what she was doing is making them realize, it's not, you're not, because sometimes when you don't chant, you'll say, well, Prabhu, why aren't you chanting anymore? Because the temple was crazy when I lived in the temple, and the temple president was like this, and the GBC was like this, and the Sankirtan leader was like this. So you're looking for someone to blame. So by saying, you don't have to chant, now there's nobody to blame. Because she was just making them realize, you know the reason you're not chanting? You really want to know the real reason is? Because you don't want to. And I said, what happened? She said, then they started chanting. Interesting, isn't it? She got rid of the guilt, she got rid of the blame, and she made them realize, you're not chanting because you don't want to. And if you want to chant, you can, and it's not because you have to. It's not because other people are pressuring you, and it's not because your temple president said something that upset you. Just because you chant if you want to. So let me read something. This is what she explained. Generally, excessive guilt throws you into a downward spiral by making it more difficult to follow the principles that you feel guilty about not following. In other words, the more guilt you feel about not following, the more you don't follow. Then the more you don't follow, the more guilt you feel. In this way, you get caught in a vicious cycle. So, how do we deal with it? Now, as I said earlier, for years, I thought somebody in ISKCON should do a workshop on this because we all have to deal with this. Why do we all have to deal with this? Because what do you read in our books? We read in our books about what a pure devotee is, right? Isn't it? Every page, this is a pure devotee. This is how a devotee acts. A devotee, Prabhupada once said, if you want, I'll make you feel guilty now. You know, this is, what do you say? You know, you're a good teacher, you give experiential learning. I'm going to make you feel guilty now. Prabhupada said, a Vaishnava, one who is a devotee, does not criticize another. He said, if you criticize, you're not a devotee. I have a question. Are there any devotees in this room today? How does that make you feel? Right. I'm not even a devotee. Right? So maybe you didn't know that Prabhupada said that. Prabhupada said, if you're envious, you're not a Vaishnava, you're in the material world. Any of us not envious? Of course, we're all envious. We're all fault finders. How does that make you feel, right? Makes you feel horrible. I'm not even a devotee. So, and there's so many things like that in Krishna consciousness that we are supposed to be and we're not. Sometimes a thought comes into your mind, a vicious, evil thought. You're looking at the deities and an evil thought comes in your mind. How does that make you feel? Horrible, right? Guilty. How can I think like that? That's crazy. Prabhupada wants, I mean, look at, we had plans for the temple 21, 22 years ago. It's still not there. Obviously, you feel something. You feel it some way. Sisi Radha Golokananda Kija. Obviously, you feel something. Some that we didn't do it. Right? Even I feel that way. I walked into the temple, I saw Prabhupada, and I felt Prabhupada saying, why did you leave? The temple's not built. I felt guilty. It's just the nature of Krishna consciousness. Sundarlal is a temple president. He's looking at the book scores, right? How many books did we distribute yesterday? Only 4. How many books did we distribute yesterday 20 years ago? 400. How does he feel? He feels like, I'm failing, right? I have to do something. It's built into the system. You can't avoid it, right? It's just we have standards. I did this service. It wasn't successful. How do you feel? You feel guilty. I didn't do it. They had to replace me. I feel guilty. Right? It's built into the system. We're going to feel that way. So I've dealt with it my entire life as a devotee, practically. And one of the things, and I want to just give you some reassurance after I've made you feel totally horrible. Is everyone feeling really bad now? Think of something, if you're not feeling bad, I'll make you feel bad now. Think of something right now to feel guilty about. Some mistake you made, some failure in your life. Just think about it right now. No, don't feel guilty. Just think about some mistake. something really stupid you've done, something you regret having done, something if you could turn the clock back, you wouldn't have done. Think about it right now and just meditate on it. Boy, do you guys look miserable right now. How do you feel? You feel guilty, right? You have to. If you're a reasonable person, you're going to feel guilty, right? If you're a hypocrite, if you're a phony, you may not even want to think about the bad thing you did, or you may think, I've never done anything bad. Right? But if you're honest, you acknowledge, I've done something bad, I failed in some way. So how do you feel? You feel bad, you feel guilty. It's just so. But I want to assure you that a lot of times when we feel guilty, we feel we haven't pleased our guru or Prabhupada. Prabhupada doesn't feel that way. It's us. I just want to throw that out there and I'll tell you a couple stories. Prabhupada had a sannyasi who did tremendous service for him, and at one point he fell down. He left with another woman and he took money from the temple. Now, you know in Mauritius, if there was a sannyasi who left this temple with all the money, or a lot of it, as much as he could get, and one of the brahmacharinis, you wouldn't be so happy to invite him back to do some programs a few years later, would you? This devotee, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. He wrote this devotee, he said, please come and see me. I want you to be with me. It's Prabhupada in his last days. Prabhupada was laying down for days. When that devotee walked in to see Prabhupada, he finally came. Prabhupada sat up. He had so much affection for this devotee. He sat up. Isn't that amazing? He said, Prabhupada, who's here? So-and-so's here. He sat up. Prabhupada said, did you bring your wife with you? This is the woman he ran off with. You think, I don't want to, you know, you think, I don't want to see that woman. She made this sannyasi fall down. You know, she made him crazy, so he took the money. You know, Prabhupada said, where's your wife? Amazing, right? Another sannyasi, he left Krishna consciousness. He did so, it was drug dealer, he did so many horrible things, and then they had a reunion. They wanted to bring him to, you know, I don't know if you were doing this. I guess it's kind of hard to do it here, but in America, they'd have these reunions where you'd invite, like a 20-year reunion. So you'd invite all the devotees that were working in the temple 20 years earlier, and you'd come together. You know, because they, you know, just a few hundred dollars they could fly in America, so they could all come to one place. It's hard to do it here. So they invited this devotee to the reunion, and he was just blaspheming Prabhupada and blaspheming the devotees. There's no way he would come, right? And he's married. He's doing all kinds of horrible, horrible, horrible things. Just cheating people, lying, stealing, drug addict. So the girl he was living with or married came to the temple after he died. And this girl did not know he was a devotee. She didn't know anything about Krishna consciousness, so she didn't know who Prabhupada was or anything. But I guess she knew, and at some point he had been a devotee, but other than that, she didn't know. She came to the temple after he died. And she said, who is Prabhupada? And they said, why? He said, because when he was leaving his body, he stood up and he said, oh, Prabhupada, you've come. Amazing, right? Amazing. The point is that these devotees did service to Prabhupada, which he never forgot. And he always accepted them. So I think it's important to understand, no matter how bad we are, no matter how fallen we are, Prabhupada and Krishna remember all the service we've done, and they accept that. And they're always willing to engage us in service. Same thing with other stories of sannyasis. They're embarrassed to see Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said, "No, come. I want to see you. How's your wife? How's your child?" All these things. It's like nothing happened. It's just. So I think it's important for us. Sometimes we may feel guilty unnecessarily. So that would be wrong. And it would also be wrong not to feel guilty when you actually did something wrong. Right? So I think we have to deal with both things. I think my nature is that if I felt I wasn't doing phenomenal, fantastic, stupendous service for Prabhupada, I would feel like I'm letting him down, so I'd feel guilty. I only distributed 20 Bhagavad Gitas a day. My godbrother distributed 30. I'm useless. That's how I would feel. I think it's just my nature. Some people, maybe they don't feel that way as much as others, but we probably all feel it to some degree. So at least we should understand that sometimes it's just us thinking that we've displeased our guru when we haven't. But, as I said, sometimes we have. Now, the logical question is, guilt is an emotion, and Krishna created it, because he created everything, so why? Why did he create the emotion? You could think, hey, life would be a lot better if there was no guilt. Right? Just like sometimes they say, "Prabhu, you want some ice cream?" I say, "Nah, doctor said I shouldn't eat it." "Oh, just take it. Don't worry. It's okay." You know. So they have this saying in America, something like guilt-free chocolate. Yeah. It's like it's healthy chocolate or something. Guilt-free ice cream. There are no preservatives or nothing unnatural. You know, something like that. Actually, they have ice cream. I don't know if you have it here. If you don't, it'd be a good business. They have ice cream made out of coconut pulp. There's no milk in it, but it tastes like ice cream. And also out of soy. So, as Prabhupada's saying, if you do something wrong, it's good if you feel guilty about it, if it's actually wrong, and that's normal. It's totally normal. So now, don't feel guilty that you feel guilty. Because guilt is normal for any normal person. If you do something bad and you don't feel guilty, that's wrong. That's definitely wrong. So why did Krishna create the emotion of guilt? What function does it have? Now, a lot of devotees don't understand that emotions carry messages. And so when devotees have emotions that aren't pleasing, they try to suppress them, or as we said earlier, try to rationalize them so that they don't feel bad, or in some way not deal with it. But the emotion, it carries a message. And so by not dealing with it, you don't get the message. What is the message of guilt? I'll give you a story. The same counselor that told people, don't chant your rounds, which was the solution to get them to, you don't have to chant, which became the solution to get them to chant. She told me, if you have a negative emotion, just allow yourself to experience it, because my natural reaction is not to experience it, especially if it's an emotion which is not Krishna conscious. Naturally, you don't want to experience it, so you just, I feel angry right now towards this devotee. And this counselor says, just feel it. I say, why do I want to feel it? You know, this is anger. This is just the modes of nature. I don't want to feel it. She said, no, feel it. I said, why? She said, because by feeling it, the emotion will guide you to a higher position. I didn't understand that, but I said, okay, I'll experiment with it. So I found something I was feeling guilty about. I don't know if I told this story in the workshop, but what happened was, up till the year 2000, I became a devotee like the end of 1969, beginning of 1970, and up to the year 2000, pretty much I was a full-time devotee, either living in the temple or outside, but I was engaged full-time. And in the year 2000, I didn't have anything. I didn't have a car, didn't have a house, didn't have money. But I had a wife who wanted a car, who wanted money, who wanted a house, which is natural. But I, being kind of the sadhu-like, was like, well, why do we need a house and a car and money? Just, you know, just Hare Krishna. She said, no Hare Krishna. Get the wife and get the money in the house and the car, and then Hare Krishna. So I said, okay, that makes sense, right? So I was, you know, I have that nature that I don't care so much about these things. If Krishna gives it, okay. If he doesn't give it, whatever, you know. So she said, no, you know, you should have children. You need a nice place for the children, you know. Need stability, money. I said, okay. So I started a business. And all of you here who are working outside, especially those who start a business, know when you start a business, you generally spend a lot of time working until your sadhana goes down. Especially in the beginning. And so I never experienced that before. That was the first time. As a devotee, I was working outside. And so, because I was working so hard, I was compromising my sadhana. And I think probably what most of you experience, when you're working like that, work, 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 and what do you do when you finish your work? You work more. You're not so inspired. So then you don't get up so early. And then you kind of shorten your sadhana to 16 rounds. And if you're a good devotee, you'll get them done before your day starts. If you're not such a good devotee, you'll chant 8 before your day starts, and you'll try to figure out how to finish, right? Somehow, yeah, finish at night when you're half asleep or something. So your sadhana just gets reduced because you're so busy. At least that was my experience. And so, about 5-6 years later, I had spoken to this devotee, and what I was feeling guilty about was the fact that for 30 years, I probably missed like 4 Mangal Artiks in 30 years. I just never missed. It was always there. That was my program, because I knew Prabhupada wanted that. And most of those 30 years, I was living in the temple. If you live in the temple, you don't really miss Mangal Arti, unless you're very sick. So I was feeling really guilty. I know Prabhupada wants, you know, Prabhupada said so many times, get up at 4 o'clock. There's even a story. The devotees were out preaching till 12:30 at night, and then it's time for Mangal Arti, and nobody's there. Prabhupada goes in the Brahmacharya ashram, starts kicking devotees. Why aren't you at Mangal Arti? Oh, Prabhupada, we didn't get back till 12:30. He said, no, you have to get up at 4 o'clock. You sleep later. So I knew that Prabhupada was very serious about that. Didn't compromise it. And I wasn't getting up. Sometimes I get up at 4, sometimes 5, sometimes 6. On a bad day, 7. Go to bed, you know, 12, 12:30, working. It's crazy. So, the devotee said, just feel the guilt. I said, you feel guilt that you're not following the order of your guru? Is that a good feeling? You want to just feel it? No. You don't want to feel that, because it just makes you feel like you're failing your guru. Why would you want to feel guilty? Why would you want to allow yourself to experience that? That's so depressing. It's so discouraging. I just feel a failure. And why do I want to sit and feel in front of my guru and feel the failure? But she said, no, there's intelligence in the emotion. It will guide you. I said, okay, I'll try it. So the next morning, I think I got up at like 5:30. And I was just chanting my rounds. I wasn't at the temple, didn't have time to go to the temple. I wasn't going to the temple that much. I lived about a 5-minute drive, but I wasn't going that much. So I just felt guilty. Feel the guilt. Bathe in the guilt. Bask in the guilt. And a very interesting thing happened to me. Very interesting. Would you like to know what happened? Should we do a guilt sangha right now? You can all just feel guilty, and you can each share what you realize. But this is what I'm telling you. This is exactly what I'm telling you to do. Whatever it is you feel guilty about, allow yourself to experience the guilt and see where it takes you. I was feeling so guilty; it was actually very painful, and it was like the guilt was causing me to confront directly my relation with Prabhupada and the fact that I wasn't doing everything he wanted. And I felt so bad that the realization I got by confronting the guilt is that the pain that I'm experiencing right now, which I've been trying to suppress for years, is so much more painful than getting up at 4 o'clock. Getting up at 4 o'clock is a lot better option. Because by getting up at 4 o'clock, I don't have to deal with that pain anymore. And that pain, until I confronted it, I didn't realize how painful it was to not be following my guru. I was trying to pretend it wasn't painful. It was very painful. I mean, everyone's situation is different. I'm just speaking from my personal experience as a disciple of Prabhupada and one of the older disciples in ISKCON and one who should be setting a good example. That was very painful for me to not be doing that. And the pain was so intense, it made me realize, Mahatma, by not doing this, this pain is much, much greater than any pain you're trying to avoid by not getting up in the morning. It's very interesting. And so the point was, I would have never got that realization by suppressing the guilt. Isn't that interesting? The guilt actually gave me some intelligence how to deal with it. So whatever you're feeling guilty about, don't suppress it. Allow yourself to experience it and allow yourself to see why is the guilt there? What is it doing? And what you realize by doing that is guilt is just directing you away from something wrong into something right. That's why Krishna created it. You know, could you imagine if we couldn't experience pain? You know, sometimes you hurt yourself and you think, why do we have to experience pain? It's painful. Say, oh, you want a body that has no pain? So you know you're cooking, right, and your finger's in the fire. You don't feel anything. You don't notice it, right? And then 3 minutes later you realize, oh, half my finger just burned off. So isn't it better when it touches the fire you feel pain, right? You can pull it out. So why does Krishna create pain? Oh, my stomach hurts. Oh, I ate something wrong. You think, what did I eat? Well, it was the popcorn and the orange juice, the ice cream, the pizza, the pineapple, tomato, eggplant, loki, sabji with too much chili. You know, you're going down the list and thinking, where along the line did it? What was that one element that caused the explosion in the meal? Right, and my stomach's going, you know. And then for a dessert, I had, you know, mangoes, strawberries, whipped cream. You know, so you go back and you go, well, maybe that was a bad combination. Maybe that I ate too much. You know, it's because you got sick. You think that way, so it's good that you got sick, so you won't do it again. So, pain, guilt is just a pain that Krishna creates to let us know. Hello, knock, knock, knock. You're doing something that you know in your heart is wrong. And I'm making you feel this way to let you know it's wrong. So don't hide from it. Allow yourself to feel it because it's going to direct you back to the right thing. That's why guilt is there. So don't run away from it. So that's the side where Prabhupada said it's good to feel guilty because it rectifies you, right? If you run away from it, how will you get rectified? If you pretend it's not there, how will you get rectified? If you don't allow yourself to feel it, how will it rectify you? It won't. Now, what's the problem? Sometimes the problem is we don't want to confront the guilt because then we have to admit that there's something to be guilty about. And the something that we're guilty about, I don't want to confront it because then it deflates my false ego. So sometimes we don't allow ourselves to feel the guilt because then it's a false ego thing. We don't want to admit that we're actually as bad as we are. We want to pretend I'm not so bad. Right? So if you did something wrong and you're not experiencing guilt, then there's something wrong with that because maybe you don't want to admit it. And if that's the case, you need to come to the humility workshop. Because the humility workshop is about, a lot of humility is about acknowledging, recognizing a fault, admitting it, and confronting it. Not pretending it's not a fault. Not pretending you didn't do it. It's actually acknowledging it and feeling bad about it. Like Bhaktivinoda Thakur sets that example. He said, look at me, I'm such a rascal. You know, I don't have any good qualities. I'm happy when people suffer. I suffer when they're happy. I'm envious. He's acknowledging that. But the interesting thing about it is that you think Bhaktivinoda Thakur is miserable when he's acknowledging that? No, he's not miserable. So that's the point. If you can acknowledge a fault, feel guilty about it in a way that moves you to Krishna, you're going to be happy because it helps you get closer to Krishna. Because the closer you get to Krishna, the happier you are. Right? So feeling miserable brings you closer to Krishna, then feeling miserable makes you happy. So we can title this lecture, The Happiness of Feeling Miserable. That would be a provocative topic, right? Like big poster, you know, when I come back next time, put it in the paper. The happiness of feeling miserable. What's that about? But it's true. When you think about it, right? If feeling miserable brings you closer to Krishna, don't you think you'll feel happy? Right, won't you? Because now you're close to Krishna. So if you've done something wrong and you feel guilty about it, and the result of the guilt will be to make you realize that was wrong, I shouldn't have done it, I don't want to do it again, it will bring you back to what is right. What is right? I should do this. Then you get closer to Krishna. Then you're going to feel happy. So now I feel guilty because my sadhana is bad. I feel really guilty. I feel so guilty, I can't even look at Prabhupada's murti in the face. I feel so bad. And feeling that, obviously that feeling is, I have to be able to reconcile my life with the order of my guru. So I want to change the fact that my sadhana was not good and do it better. So now I can again feel right with my guru and feel better. And that's what the guilt did to me. Because I felt so bad that I was not doing what Prabhupada wanted. I'll tell you another thing. I went back to a temple that I was temple president of in 1970. I only visited, after I left in like 72, I visited it once. No, I never even visited the temple. The first time I visited the temple since I was temple president, I left there in 1972, was last September. So that was like 41 years. And due to some problems, the temple was completely dilapidated and everyone in the temple was complaining and miserable. Mauritians complain, but they're happy. The complaining doesn't make them unhappy. They're still happy. But honestly, in that temple, when I walked on that property, within 1 minute, I could feel something was wrong. I just looked around the property. Things were dilapidated. I saw a few devotees. They didn't even say hello. They just looked miserable. I mean, you'd understand, you walk in a temple like that, you'd understand, something's wrong here. They didn't even say hello. I said, something's wrong here. And so I was in the temple and I felt guilty. I said, I was a temple president here 43 years ago. And I told the devotees, I'll come back. I want to help you. I'll come back. It's like, so that feeling guilty kind of was like, Prabhupada, I was here. Look at it now. Yeah, I'm not feeling right. So, but that directs me to want to do some service. So it brings me closer. So the guilt can be very powerful in bringing you closer to Krishna. And so the point is, don't avoid it when you feel guilty. Allow yourself to feel it and see what it's doing. Guilt is saying, you did this, but you should have done that. And if you allow yourself to feel it, it starts to push you towards what you should do. Now, we were speaking in the forgiveness workshop about this saying that the best apology is right action. In other words, you could apologize by saying, I'm sorry, and not do anything. And then that could just be an excuse. So you think, if I say I'm sorry, it's okay. Everything's rectified. Krishna Chandra, let's say I borrowed 1,000,000 rupees from you. And then I was having financial trouble, so I paid you half back, but at a certain point I said, I'm having trouble paying you back. I don't know what I'm going to do. And Krishna Chandra says, well, you know, do something. You know, if you can't pay me, you know, 100,000 rupees a month, pay me 50, do something. And I say, I'm really sorry, Prabhu, but I can't. That's not going to make him happy that I... And he says, oh, Mahatma said he's sorry. Oh, everything's okay. No, he's going to think, Mahatma thinks he can tell me he's sorry and that's as good as paying back the debt? That's bogus. So sometimes when we say, I'm sorry, it's an excuse. What does Krishna Chandra want to hear? He wants to hear, okay, I think, you just give me a few months, I have to do this and that, I'll be a little late on the payments, but we'll get it done. That's what he wants to hear, right? He doesn't want to hear, oh, I'm sorry is okay. He wants to hear, I'm sorry, and then he wants to hear a sentence after that, which is, what are you going to do? He just doesn't want to hear half of it. I'm sorry, Krishna. Then here's another one. This is the best one. This is really good. If you owe somebody money, try this one. Hope they don't shoot you. I'm sorry, but, and give an excuse why you can't pay. So then he's going to, I'm sorry, Krishna Chandra, but my business fell apart because they opened another shop next to mine selling the same product and they invested 10 times more money in it and they have 10 times more inventory and everybody's going there. So what's Krishna Chandra going to say? He say, I'm sorry to hear that, but can you borrow the money and pay me back? You have to do something. Because I have a good excuse doesn't mean the fault has been rectified, does it? So you say, I'm sorry, and then you add a good excuse, and then what? Then that's okay now? You know, sometimes you're late for a program, right? So, you know, you're having a meeting, you know. Meeting starts at 7 o'clock, committee meeting. You come at 7:20. So you're thinking, well, if I have a good excuse, then I'm okay, right? That's the thinking. I'm sorry, and is my excuse, you know. I ran out of petrol. That's not a good excuse. You know, or, you know, this or that. You know, if it's something unavoidable, okay, it's a good excuse. But sometimes we think, well, if I come up with a good excuse, then I'm off the hook. It's okay. Don't think that way. Does Krishna Chandra want a good excuse? No. So the best apologies are right actions. So I feel guilty. I've done this. What do I do now? Do I just suppress the guilt so I don't feel bad anymore and just keep doing it? Is that a good solution? It's a very bad solution. Then nothing changes. Feel guilty. If you allow yourself to feel guilty, you'll rectify yourself. And then you'll start doing the right thing. So the guilt helped you do the right thing because the guilt was only there because you were doing the wrong thing. Because if you were doing the right thing, you wouldn't feel guilty in the first place. So that's the purpose of guilt. It's Krishna's, right? He arranges us to feel bad when we do something that's wrong. So we can rectify it. So don't run away from it. Now, something very important for us. I began this talk by saying we feel guilty because we are told how we should live, how we should think, and what we should do, and we don't always do it. Prabhus and Matajis, there is a problem if we expect everyone to be perfect and we expect ourselves to be perfect. We are going to drive one another crazy and we're going to drive ourselves crazy. And if you already have driven one another crazy, that's probably the reason, because you're expecting everyone to be perfect. People make mistakes, don't they? You've noticed that? Is it okay for people to make mistakes? Of course it's okay. Is it okay if you make a mistake? Yeah, make it once and rectify it. It's not okay to keep making the same mistake the rest of your life. It's okay to make a mistake, you learn, and then, right? That's the idea. So now, another reason that guilt may be unhealthy is that we create standards for ourselves that are virtually impossible to meet. You know, unless I'm a good devotee, if I don't chant 64 rounds a day, if I don't get up at 2 o'clock, if I don't do this and that, I'm useless. I'm a bum. And so, you know, how's it going today, Prabhu? Terrible. Why? I only chanted 48 rounds and I got up at 2:15. I'm completely miserable. It's possible to think that way. Do you realize that? That if you said, I can only feel good with myself and only feel like I'm a good devotee if I get up at 2 o'clock and chant 64 rounds and read for 5 hours and distribute 100 Gitas. And if you don't do that, you're going to feel miserable. Do you realize that? You will. You'll feel useless. You'll feel like a failure. It's true. Because all of us have a standard of which we understand or believe, this is a standard I should be on. The problem is, sometimes some of us have a standard that's way beyond what we're going to meet, you know, on a daily basis. It's too high for us. So, here's a conversation with another counselor in ISKCON. Very good advice. Again, we're going back to this problem of vows. I say, what do you do if somebody cannot follow their vows because they feel miserable? She said you make interim goals. You can't do this. Can you do this? And then once you do this, can you do this? And once you do this, can you do this? And once you do this, can you do this? You make goals. Now, I have been having a very interesting discussion with a group of devotees about the four regulative principles. Not about the four, about the regulative principle of no illicit sex. And the reason this discussion is interesting is because the question has come up, what does that actually mean, no illicit sex? You know, you take initiation, what were you thinking that meant? What was your guru thinking that meant? What does Prabhupada think that means? What do the Shastras say about it? There's actually a little bit of ambiguity. You know what ambiguity means? It's not clear exactly what it is in ISKCON. Because if you ask different devotees, and I'm not talking about just any devotees, senior devotees, what did Prabhupada mean by no illicit sex? You're going to actually get different answers. Did you know that? Did anybody know that? That there's more than one answer? Wow, that's interesting. What answers are you going to get? Well, one answer you're going to get is no illicit sex means sex only in marriage, only for procreation, only after you chant 50 rounds. Anything other than that is illicit sex. On the other end of the spectrum, someone's going to say, Prabhupada said, no illicit sex means no sex outside of marriage. So if you, before you're married, you don't have sex, you only have sex with your wife. When you take vanaprast, you don't have sex, sannyas, you don't have sex, that's no illicit sex. So there's a low standard and there's a high standard. And you think, well, why would devotees not agree on the standard? Because there are enough things that Prabhupada said and enough experience we have over the last 40 years to help us understand that not everybody, when they're 22 years old, the day after they get married, can follow this high standard. Some can. And one devotee said something funny. Would you like to hear it? She's a counselor. And one thing about counselors is they know what's going on in ISKCON because all the devotees who come to them tell them everything. They tell them things they would not tell their guru. It's amazing to be a counselor. I have devotees. They tell me things. And at the end they say, I don't know why I told you. I told you everything about my life. So when you're in a counselor relationship, people open up. And they tell you. And she said, you know which devotees follow the 50-round rule perfectly? Which couples? She said, the ones, they hate one another so much, they could never get close enough to break the principle. they dislike one another so much, they're never together. She said, definitely they follow it. And she said, and very, very senior, advanced, staunch devotees, they follow it. But she said, that's a small percentage. She said, and everybody else, it's somewhere along the line. And then gradually in their advancement of Krishna consciousness, they get to that standard. So what was the point? Everyone's going to go home and go, hey, let's have a celebration. Mahatma said there's two standards now. That's not the point. But the point is that if you can't follow this, you know, perfectly, this standard of 50 rounds procreation, you know, occasionally, once in a while, you can't follow it, or even on a more regular basis, you can't follow it, you don't decide, well, I should commit suicide or give up or feel horrible, but you realize there is another standard. It's not the ultimate standard you want to achieve, but it's a standard which is still acceptable in a broader sense. So I'm not so bad. It's just, I'm on this standard. Okay, I'm on the no illicit sex standard, but it's not the 50-round procreation. But I know the goal is 50 rounds procreation. That's where I'm going. Now, if you're on the lower standard and you say, I don't care about the higher standard, that's a mistake. But if you're on the lower standard, and the lower standard is still okay because the lower standard is going to get you to the higher standard someday, then you're good. If the lower standard's not going to get you to the higher standard, you know, then you're in trouble. So now it's time for another joke. Would you like to hear another joke? This is a good one. It's about celibacy. Christian monks are celibate. Catholic monks are celibate. They live a very austere life. More, at least they're supposed to. More austere than we do. At least in terms of what they eat, it's more austere. And they also rise early and they pray and like that. So in the olden days in the Catholic Church, before printing presses, they would have to handwrite the scriptures. So that was one of the services that the monks did. I guess it was the Bible, and they would handwrite it, or other scriptures and teachings. So one monk who had been there for like 50 years, after 50 years of copying these scriptures, he's copying from the copies. He's not copying from the original, because the original, you don't want to let the original go. The original is locked up. And after 50 years, he thinks, wait a minute, what if someone made a mistake copying? Then we're all copying the mistake. So he went to the head monk, the rector, or whatever you call him, and said, he explained that. He said, you know, maybe we're copying something that was copied wrong, and we're perpetuating an ill truth. He said, that's a good idea. He said, we should go to the original. So he took one of the copies they made, and he went to the original, and he went down where they, in the cellar, in the basement, where they keep the original. And he'd been going through it, and he'd been down there for like 10 hours. What's going on? Hasn't he come up? I guess this wasn't the whole Bible. It was some document that he could have gone through more quickly. And so the head of the monastery went down, and he saw this monk. He was crying. He said, what's wrong? What's wrong? He was hysterically crying. He said, what's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? Tell me what's wrong. He said, it's not celibate. It's not celibate. It's celebrate. 50 years of celibacy. Torture. 50 years of torture. And it was celebrate, not celibate. So what I'm saying is, sometimes we're hard on ourselves because we know this is the standard. You know, if I were a surrender devotee, I would do this. And I'm not doing it, so I feel bad. I'm so bad, I'm so horrible. I'm so bad. You walk around, I'm so bad, I'm so horrible. I'm such a bad devotee, I'm horrible. Yeah. We want to avoid that because that's not how we progress in devotional service. As we're saying, it's okay to feel bad if it pushes you towards the goal. And so, okay, I'm a bad devotee. The goal's up here. So I'm not perfect yet. You're not perfect. I'm not perfect. Nobody's perfect. That's okay. We're working towards perfection. So what can I do now, a little bit above, where I'm maybe not at perfection, but I'm here, so I can feel good about myself? I do something very, what you'll think is very weird, and you're going to think, this is not Krishna conscious. I do something in a workshop to help devotees get over this negativity. Because some devotees feel very bad about themselves. Like, I don't have any good qualities, I'm not a good devotee, I'm not this, I'm not that. I say, Prabhu, what do you like about yourself? Nothing really, like that. Right? So that's not the mentality. That's an unhealthy mentality. So in this workshop, we do an exercise, and you sit with a devotee, and you're going to think this is weird, but it actually helps. You tell the devotee everything you like about yourself. And you think, well, that's not being humble. No, but it's just to acknowledge you're not that bad. You have good qualities. Just as we said, Prabhupada accepts everyone's service. Prabhupada sees all the good qualities that we have. So what do you like about? Well, I like that I can sing. I like that I can lecture. I like that, you know, devotees like me. You just go down the list. Well, you know, well, I can paint and, you know, whatever. Even if it's just, well, I'm a good cleaner. It doesn't matter what it is. You know, I clean well. Or, you know, whatever. So, Krishna consciousness, it shouldn't mean, okay, I'm on this level, I can't get to this level, so I have to try for a level, three levels down, so that's misery and I'm so bad. No. We don't want to think that way. We want to think, okay, this is what I can do now, and when I get here, I'm going to look to the next level. So it's progressive, it's positive. We're moving forward. Right? That's healthy. So that's what we want to do. We want to be healthy. We want to be encouraged. Yeah, how are you doing? I'm doing good. You know? Where things are moving forward. You know? Maybe in 40 years I'll be able to achieve this position. That's okay. 40 years is nothing. You know, devotees would tell Prabhupada, he'd say, Prabhupada, becoming Krishna conscious in one life, that's so long. It takes so long. Prabhupada said, it's only 70 years. You know, we're so impatient, you know. Well, what if it takes me 40 years to be Krishna conscious? Well, what's the problem? You've been in the material world 40 billion, zillion, quadrillion lifetimes, and you're going to get it in 40 years? What's wrong with you? Why not be patient? It doesn't make sense, does it? Right? So. Okay, so this, then this. Then this, then this, then this, then this. So that's something all of you have to look in your own life. If your frustration and your guilt is simply because you have goals which are impossible for you to achieve in your present level of advancement, just come down a little bit to things that you can achieve. Then you'll be more positive because you'll see your progress. Oh, I did this. I was able to do this. Right? Let's say you've been married and divorced 23 times. So progress for you is to get married the 24th and stay with that wife the rest of your life. That's obviously not progress for a sannyasi, but that's progress for you. So it's all going to be relative. You have to look at what is progress for you. Right? So there's two sides of this guilt. We're saying we want to allow the guilt to push us forward, but we also want to be realistic about how far forward we can go, so we then don't become discouraged when we don't achieve that goal. So, okay, I was guilty because I wasn't getting up every day at 4 o'clock, so I start getting up at 4 o'clock, right? Today, I got up at 4:29. So, because I got up at 4:29, I went in the closet and got a knife and decided I was going to commit suicide because I got up at 4:29. Now, is that what I should do? No. I knew if I didn't get up at 4:29, I wouldn't be sitting on Svyasasan. I was so tired. You know. So it's just I had to be reasonable, you know. I'm exhausted. I'm going to bed late, getting up early every morning, you know. So, you know, sometimes we just have to be reasonable with ourselves and know what's practical and what's possible. So, like that. So, does anyone have any questions on this? Comments? Yes? Jai, Hari Bol. Yes.
For a great religion. Now, if one reads another, one initiated devotee will vow to his spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, that he will follow for a great religion. But in practical terms, he doesn't come to.
He's not.
He doesn't come to that level. So he set up a substandard for himself, according to what you mentioned, one counselor, you know.
Like he's chanting 8 rounds or something?
Yeah. So, not for him, but he had a vow.
Yes, right, right.
And how did Krishna see from his eye and Prabhupada's eye?
Right. Well, that's difficult to answer. I think it's easier to answer from Prabhupada's point of view. Prabhupada's point of view is he accepted what anybody did. He accepted everybody's service on whatever standard. Of course, he wanted them to come to the standard, but I think from Prabhupada's vision, he'll see it as that you're harming yourself. It's not like you're harming me. You know, this is, you know, just like your son, you may want your son to be a lawyer, and he decides he just wants to be a mechanic. And you think, well, if you're a mechanic, you won't make so much money, and you'll have to hang around with other mechanics, and they're not, you know, lawyers are more cultured than mechanics. But he decides to be a mechanic, so what can you do? You're hoping someday maybe he'll go back to school and become a lawyer. So I think from Prabhupada's point of view, it's more like, okay, whatever service you've done, I accept that. Whatever sincerity you have, I accept that. But your chanting of 8 rounds, it's harming you. You know, and if you want to be fully Krishna conscious, then please follow the instructions as I've given them to you. Now, this doesn't deny there may be a natural relationship or affection that Prabhupada or your spiritual master or any spiritual master has with their disciple, where when they see their disciple not following, that they feel hurt personally because of affection. They want that disciple to become a pure devotee in this lifetime. So it's not a hurt that comes out of anything other than affection. So let's say you're not following, and your spiritual master's hurt, not that you're hurting him personally, but he's hurt because he wants you. He sees that maybe you won't be Krishna conscious in this life. So I think that's how Prabhupada was not offended personally by people who didn't follow. And actually one time Prabhupada said, they said somebody blooped or left Krishna consciousness, or they said he's not a devotee, and Prabhupada said, does he eat meat? And they said no, and then Prabhupada said he's still a devotee. He said the criterion is if he eats meat, then you can say he's not a devotee. But even he's not chanting now, even he's not following any of the principles, at least if he's vegetarian, he believes in Krishna, and Prabhupada said he's still a devotee. Then we'd have to say, well, if Prabhupada feels that way, Krishna will go along with it, right? And then I also wanted to say that sometimes a devotee, for whatever reason, is not able to chant 16 rounds. Of course, we know the reason is because they don't want to, or they're losing taste. But sometimes, you know, a woman is pregnant, she's ill, she just gives birth, she's finding it hard chant her rounds, she's so busy, and then after the kid's a little grown up, then she's used to not chanting and she's trying to get back into it. This is common. And so sometimes that devotee will go to their guru and say, Guru Maharaj, can for now we change the vow to 8 because this is all I can do? And sometimes the guru will say, okay, chant 8 and then work to get back up. One devotee, he was a leading devotee, sannyasi, temple president, he wasn't chanting any rounds, and they'd go to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said, what can I do? Just encourage him. Because Prabhupada tried to encourage him, and he wasn't chanting. But he was doing phenomenal service, so Prabhupada let him stay as temple president. Even there was one temple president he wasn't following so strictly, and they removed him. And Prabhupada was very upset and said, "Why did you remove him? I liked him. I liked what he was doing." So he liked him as temple president, even though he wasn't, this is what he said, but he's not chanting his rounds all the time. But he had done such nice service, and Prabhupada had such an affectionate relationship. Prabhupada liked him and wanted him to be the temple president. And I think Prabhupada knew that if he was encouraged and he was in the right situation, again, he would start chanting. So Prabhupada is very liberal in that way, out of affection for his disciples. So I think the mistake that we make, and I see this, that sometimes as a godbrother or other godbrothers sometimes are critical of another godbrother, and on my mind I think, but this devotee did so much service to Prabhupada and Prabhupada has so much affection for him, we should be careful that even though now maybe what he's doing seems not to be pleasing to Prabhupada, we should be careful not to criticize him, because Prabhupada may still be very pleased with him. You know, so it's a thing of affection. But the other side, you know, as an individual, we should think, oh, but I did make this vow. Again, that's my goal, to follow it. I'm not following it now, but it's my goal. It's a reality within our organization that a lot of people take vows that they later have difficulty following. Another thing I would like to say, and I mentioned this in my japa workshop, that the vow of 16 rounds is not that somehow or other you get your rounds done. That's not the vow, but 16 good rounds. So not, you know, just chant in the car, you chant here, there, Hare Krishna, you do your laundry, you're chanting, you're cleaning, you're chanting. Looking at your email, you're chanting, you're reading, you're chanting. That's not the vow you took. You took a vow to sit and focus and be absorbed in chanting. So we should know that. Don't think, well, I chant 16 rounds, I follow the principles. That's enough. No, it's not enough. You have to chant your rounds properly. You have to advance. That's the point. So then, you know, in answer to your question, you could say the devotee chanting 8 rounds and maybe following the broader principle of illicit sex could possibly be making more advancement than one who's strictly following because their attitude is wrong or their chanting is not good. Or maybe they're chanting well, but they're proud. They think they're a better devotee. You know? So it's not always just, you can't always just tell externally. You know, well, I'm a good devotee because I strictly follow. But what about your attitude? What about your heart? You may strictly follow, but your motive is wrong. So, you know, that just shows that bhakti is not just rules and regulations. The rules and regulations are there, but bhakti is about the heart. You know, like the prostitute, oh, I'm so bad, I'm so bad. And the Brahmin, I'm so great, you know, and the prostitute's so bad. So externally, she was bad, and externally, he was good. But internally, she was good, and internally, he was bad. So it doesn't mean just because you have everything externally good, you're better than everybody, because your attitude may be wrong. Yes.
How does it apply like for guilt and forgiveness? Generally from like a senior to a senior. But does it apply like a senior devotee or even a Guru Maharaj?
Could ask forgiveness from a junior? Of course. Yeah. Of course. If we offend anyone, junior, senior, equal, yeah. We should always ask for forgiveness. And we should always accept a request to be forgiven. If someone asks us, please forgive me. You know, according to etiquette, the idea is that respect goes up, affection goes down. So it seems awkward that a senior would ask forgiveness from a junior. We were told, I think this is true, maybe you've heard, that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, when his disciples would bow down, he would bow down to them and he would say, Dasosmi, I'm your servant. So naturally, as one becomes more advanced, if he feels that he offended anyone, then he'll ask for forgiveness. It won't matter what status that person is. Progression or procreation?
Progress.
Oh yeah, that's a good point. It's really nice. You know, Bhaktisiddhanta said, if Krishna wanted, I would have, what did he say? I'd have sex 100 times or I'd have 100 children. It's just an interesting thing to meditate on, that he was so detached to do whatever Krishna wanted. Naistiki Brahmachari was willing to have sex 100 times if it satisfied Krishna, whatever pleases Krishna. That's another point. Yes?
Yeah, because of progression in bhakti, Prabhupada said that if we come to the level of unacceptability, then our progression accelerates.
Yes, yes,
so
definitely.
I consider this would be a system of check.
How to know you're on Anartha Nivritti?
Yes. So what do you say on that?
Krishna Chandra is asking, he said that Shastra says when you get to Anartha Nivritti, then acceleration. The real acceleration is actually at Ruchi, but Ruchi comes right behind Anartha Nivritti, because when you're not trying to taste material, then you can taste the spiritual. So after you overcome your Anarthas, then the next stage is you become fixed, because there's nothing to pull you this way or that way. The anarthas pull you off the path, right? So now you're not being pulled off the path, so now you can go quicker. So like Anartha Nivritti was like the roads in Mauritius, all the potholes before you got all these new roads. Those were the anarthas, right? So you're driving. We used to go to Suriname, it'd take us like half a day to get there. The roads were so bad. Right? So, but when the roads are repaved, there's no potholes, then you just go straight. So Anartha Nivritti, you're getting pulled this way, pulled that way by anarthas. And then, so you overcome the anarthas, then you can be nishta. Now we just drive straight on the road, because there's no potholes to drive around. That's nishta, right? And that's when the taste comes. Oh, these roads are so nice. Because now I don't have to drive around potholes. So when you have a taste, that means nothing's deviating you, and you can just go on the road to Krishna. So that's when it really happens. So Krishna Chandra is saying, well, how do you know you're coming to this Anartha Nivritti platform? You know it because you're not being pulled, you're hardly being pulled away from Krishna by anything. You know, it's just your day is all Krishna conscious. It's not like you're really struggling with your mind, your senses, your heart, or you're struggling with some serious anarthas. It doesn't mean the anarthas are not there, it just means you're not struggling with them. They're not really doing anything. You know, it's like, let's say I'm envious of somebody and then I fault find. Well, a higher stage is I'm envious but I don't fault find. I don't say anything. So, Anartha Nivritti platform would be more like, I recognize I don't like this devotee, but I don't say anything. Because I don't have to, because I'm on a higher stage now. Or I recognize that I have lust, but it's not enough that I'm really worried that anything's going to happen. Or there's not enough envy that I'm worried that I'm going to criticize a devotee or I'm going to do something in some way to push him out of the way. It's just not strong enough. So you're above it. It's like you're above the clouds of anarthas. So you know you're on the Anartha Nivritti platform basically because you're nishta, because your service, your everything is just, it's pretty straight. You're not, you know, one day you have a great day, one day you have a bad day. One day, you know, you think, oh my God, these women are so attractive. Krishna, why did you make them so beautiful? They're driving me crazy. You want to hear another joke? Yes. One man went to God and said, God, why did you make women so beautiful, so attractive, that I cannot control myself? But, you know, I just want to be with them and around them and see them and touch them. But you made them so stupid. Wow. I want to be around them. They're so stupid. Why did you do that? God said, so they would be stupid enough to marry you. So, you know, it's not that one day you wake up and you go, oh my God, this women, or oh my God, this devotee, I saw this devotee and I just can't stand, he got this position in the temple, I can't stand it. And the next day you're like, congratulate the devotee, thank you. And the next day, oh, Mataji. That's not nishta, that's not anartha nivritti. But in anartha nivritti, you notice, oh yeah, women are attractive. It doesn't, it's like, it just passes right, it doesn't register. It's like, doesn't do anything. Of course they're attractive, so what? You know, I'm chanting Hare Krishna, what does it matter? Or, you know, envy, of course I'm envious. It doesn't matter. I can congratulate the devotee I'm envious of, because the anartha doesn't really have hold on you anymore. It's like we say, you take the wind out of the sails, you know? It's like, you have a sailboat, but there's no wind. It's not going anywhere. The cell's still there. So the anarthas are there, but it's really, they don't bother you. So then you're nishta. So that's how you know. And the more you're coming to that platform, the more you're coming to anartha nivritti. But when you get past anartha nivritti, where you're steady, that's when the taste comes. And how do you know you're getting ruchi? Because you don't have to force yourself in devotional service. You want to get up. When it's 5 a.m, it's time to chant japa, you don't go, oh, I wish I didn't have to do this. You know, you don't say, wow, 16 rounds, it's so much. No, you say, nectar, japa, that's ruchi. You know, let's go to the temple, we can see Krishna. Let's read Bhagavatam, let's meet with some devotees and discuss Krishna Katha. That's how you know you're on ruchi. Because the reason you're doing it now is because you want to, you like doing it. Before you get to ruchi, it's, okay, I'm going to do it out of duty. I have to. So, you know, I'll sit straight. I'll try to concentrate. This is going to be hard, but I'll do it. I'll force myself. But ruchi is, it's natural. So those are some of the symptoms. And if you're really struggling and you're up and down, then you're not yet on the north end of ruchi. Bhajana Kriya, practice. But it's a continuum, so it's not overnight. So it gradually gets better. So you'll feel it. You'll feel the wind's not so strong. You'll just feel, you know, I have these attractions or these feelings, but I still feel them, but not much. I know they're there, but I don't think about them that much. Sometimes I don't think about them for months. I don't notice them. Wouldn't that be great? That all these anarthas, you just don't notice them? Wow, what a life. And then you come to the stage of ruchi. And the paradox is those anarthas we think will make us happy. You know, like the envy is going to make me happy. The lust is going to make me happy. The jealousy is going to make me happy. The anger is going to make me happy. We think the very anartha is the thing that will make us happy. But the paradox is, as long as we act on those anarthas, we never get to ruchi. And ruchi is when you become happy. So the anartha you think is going to make you happy is preventing you from actually becoming happy. So that's the paradox. So we should understand that. You think, oh, I'm so attracted to this. No. If you're attracted to that and you pursue that sense gratification, it's going to hold you from coming to a higher level of bhakti where you really be happy, right? That's where the ecstasy is. It's up here. It's not down on the anartha level. Does that make sense? Yes? Strength in prayer is better than length in prayer? Yeah. You want another one like that? The family that dances together advances together? The family that sings together clings together? Yes. Intensity of prayer. Your intensity when you're what you're praying for. Yes. So should we stop now? Oh yeah. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. She's saying we should feel the guilt, experience it, and then rectify it. And some we can rectify very quickly, some within a few days, and some within years. Then I think we go back to that example of step by step. As long as you know what the goal is and your aim is to achieve it, then be patient. Very, very important for us as devotees to not become discouraged. We can become very discouraged about where we are now, because you look at the goal and say, the goal's up there and I'm down here. But the smart devotee doesn't focus on what's wrong here, but he focuses on what's right on the goal, and then what I can do to get to the goal. So your mind's focused on the goal. Focus on where you want to go. Don't focus on what's so bad about it down here. I mean, you have to know what's bad, but your focus is. So we always want to focus on where we're going. It's very powerful. But there's a lot of us focus on the bad, and then it keeps us. You know, what's wrong? This is wrong. Like, you could, let's have a committee meeting and focus on what's wrong. We'll have two committees. One committee, your services focus on what's wrong in Mauritius. And the other committee, focus on what we want to achieve. What committee would you want to follow? What conclusions of what committee would you want to follow? And what committee would you want to be on? Because the first committee, they're going to come out pretty miserable. But the second committee is going to come out pretty inspired. I was telling Sundarlal, I said, Sundarlal, why don't you have a committee meeting and brainstorm and not consider what's practical, but just how could we make Mauritius, where would we like Mauritius, what would we like the preaching to be like and the movement to be like 20 years from now? And just imagine what we would like it to be like. It doesn't have to be practical. How would you like to see? And then this country. Then, of course, you have to imagine what society is going to be like 20 years from now. And you think, well, in 20 years in Mauritius, it's going to be like this. So if it's going to be like this, are we going to be up to date with the times? Are we, you know, then everybody's getting excited and thinking, yeah, well, in 20 years, everybody's going to be doing this and that, you know. Well, what are we going to be doing? You say, oh, we should have a Krishna land in Mauritius, and then the tourists will come to Krishna land. You know, you're not thinking practically. That'll cost like 500 million rupees. It doesn't matter if it's practical or not. You just think, wow, we'll have Krishna land, you know, 100 acres, you know, and this and that, and all the tourists will come because, you know, 20 years from now, there's going to be more tourists because the government's pushing tourism, and they expect in 20 years to have 10 times more tourists. So we have to be ready for the tourists, you know. What else are we going to do? So you're looking at things you could do. It's much more exciting than this committee that's looking at all the things that are wrong, right? Because when you look at what's wrong, it just gets discouraged and you get stuck. So use that example in your own life. You look at what's wrong. Oh, I'm not this, I'm not that, I'm not this, I'm not that. Why don't you look at what you could be 20 years from now? That's a lot more fun. It's a more exciting. Well, in 20 years, I could be living in Vrindavan, you know, doing this service. You know, obviously I'll advance in 20 years. How advanced do you want to be in 20 years? Why not meditate on that rather than, I'm such a bad devotee and this and that. Why not meditate on qualities you would like to achieve 20 years from now? And think, that's my goal. I want to be like this, like that. That's inspiring. So that's how we can remain encouraged in bhakti. Even in the present time, it's not so good. Because you look toward, what can we do? You know, it's so bad here. 20 years ago, we're supposed to build a temple. Haven't built it. What's the use? I quit. You guys are bums, useless, you can't do anything. I'm out of here. You know? Let me go build my own temple, you know. I'll build one better than you, just to show you. You know? No, but the meditation is, what kind of temple do we want? What would be beautiful? What we could do, you know? When I was here, I'd meditate on all kinds of crazy ideas. The only thing that kept me sane, because the present was so hellish, I had to think of the future. So if I didn't think of the future, I would have committed suicide. I'm serious. That's what kept me going. I had all kinds of plans for this. I had crazy plans for this place. Yeah, and that's what kept me inspired. I was like, I'm going to build this. no, you've never seen this on the island before, we're going to do this. And be hundreds of thousands of people will come to see this, and we'll have this. And that kept me inspired. And we're going to have these kinds of festivals. And sometimes the present is so bad, if you don't think of the future, you don't want to live. Yeah. Isn't it? It's like, look how Krishna conscious I am. I'm not Krishna conscious. It's depressing. You know, I hardly, but I could be. You know, look at so-and-so Maharaj. Look at so-and-so Prabhu. How Krishna conscious they are. If they're that Krishna conscious, there's hope for me in the future. I can be Krishna conscious. If I just get a drop of what they have, I'll be happy. So you look for that. You look towards that. You know? It's like Prabhupada said, Mauritius could be the first Krishna conscious country. So what I think would be really fun to do is to have a meeting with all the people who have the good brains and anyone who wants to come and say, okay, how could we make Mauritius Krishna conscious? How long would it take? You know, that would be fun, you know. You say, all right, you know, we're going to make this minister a devotee. Okay, who's in charge of making him a devotee? Oh, you are, yeah. You know, so-and-so is going to become the next prime minister of, you know, we're already training, you know, our children, you know, you're going to law school and you're going to become a member of parliament. You're going to be the next prime, you know, just have fun with it, you know. How? Because you realize if you're going to do it, you start to realize if you're going to do it, that's what you have to do, right? You have to position yourself. How would we be the most influential enough to make this place Krishna conscious? Like, that would be fun. That would be inspiring, you know. You could make it a game. You know? We can make a little game. Make Mauritius Krishna conscious. You know? You all have a little, play your parts like Monopoly or something. So that would be inspiring, you know. And then you realize, actually, if you did that exercise, you would probably realize there's things we should be doing now we're not doing, even though that was just for fun. You say, actually, I realize by doing that, we should be doing this program, because if we do that, it's going to make the island more Krishna conscious. Yeah? So that's what inspires me, because it's moving forward. And Prabhupada was like that. He was always moving forward. You know, what happened? We had a marathon. We broke all the records. We distributed so many books. We couldn't believe how many books we distributed. It was like phenomenal. And Prabhupada said, in the history of the world, no one has distributed so many religious books. And then he signs it, now next year, double it. That's Prabhupada. You know, that's just how he thought, you know. Always the impossible. Always the impossible. I think they were printing one book. They were translating and doing the paintings. Not translating. It took them 6 months to do one book. BBT. And Prabhupada said, I want to do 17 in 2 months. It takes 1 6. So the devotees got together and they said something like, Prabhupada, we all met and we realized we could do one book a month, which is a lot better than one every six. And Prabhupada said, 17 in 2 months. And they said, impossible. And then Prabhupada quoted, I don't know who said this, impossible is a word in a fool's dictionary. So that was Prabhupada, you know. Okay, you went from 2 books a year to 12 books a year, and you're thinking, that's progress. That's right on the limits of the threshold of human potential. And Prabhupada said, no, 17 in 2 months. That's how Prabhupada thought. So that's exciting. That's why Krishna consciousness was exciting. Prabhupada sees some disciple. Okay, you go. Start a temple here. In South Africa, there's a devotee named Chudi. He went there when he was 17 years old. He went with another devotee named Rohini Kumar to open up South Africa. They had been there a few months. Rohini Kumar one day left. Chudi, a 17-year-old, maybe by 18, he's left alone in South Africa. He writes Prabhupada, what should I do? You'd think Prabhupada would say, come back to America. He says, stay there. Alone, 18-year-old boy in South Africa, stay there. Amazing. That's Prabhupada, you know, the impossible. Okay, you go open a temple. I don't know how to open a temple. No, go do it. The future, what will come of it? That's what's exciting. Isn't it? I mean, don't you think it'd be exciting to have a meeting, how to make Mauritius Krishna conscious, even though it's completely impractical. It would be fun, right? And one of these devotees in this room or coming in the future, you keep the notes of those meetings. Someday, some devotee, some youth, some ambitious youth is going to read those notes and go, I could do this. It could be 100 years from now. 100 years from now, they go, look at this meeting they had in 2013. This was their plan. And they might look at this plan and go, my God, this was ingenious. But they didn't do it. Let's do it. Or they'll curse you and say, why didn't you do it? Now look at this island. It's completely materialistic. They say, there's a really good meditation, especially for here. They say, you should work now with the thought of 6 generations ahead, what your work is doing, how it will affect it. And so you know, what is Mauritius going to look like? 20, 30, 40 years. It's going to look like South Africa. It's just going to be a modern city, right? You have more land, maybe. But other than that, it's just, you know, it'll get upgraded. The cities will get upgraded. Eventually, the villages will get upgraded at, you know, a certain point. So, and then, you know, future generations of devotees will say, why didn't you guys do this? You know, this country is becoming materialistic. And it's now Mauritius, which Prabhupada said could be the first Krishna conscious country. It's like every city in the world. Everybody's working, you know, 12 hours a day. It's industrialized. It's hellish like every other place. Why didn't you guys do anything? We'll all get cursed. You know, that's a nice way to think. 60 years from now or 100 years from now, what are we doing now? How is it going to affect that? It's fun. It's exciting. And even if you can only do one thing, it's one more thing than you thought you were of doing, right? Yes. Yes.
So the end part, actually it was done in time. I decided. And then it's sending copy to Srila Prabhupada, who was in Vrindavan. So then Prabhupada said, oh, you're one day late.
One day late of the 2 months. When Prabhupada got the full set of Chaitanya Charitamrita, they were one day late, yeah. So, anyway. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gopremanandi, Adi Hari Bol.